Parshas Mishpatim, the first Aliyah, begins essentially by introducing us to the concept of Mishpatim, telling us, Ve'elah HaMishpatim Asher Tosim Lifnehem, these are the rules that you shall place before them. And referring to placing these rules in front of them, Rashi quotes a Michilta that tells us that apparently Moshe wasn't prepared to actually go into depth, and he wanted to just give somewhat of a cursory introduction to these rules, that they would become a little bit familiar with them, and the Kadosh Baruch Hu says, no, you have to actually explain them in detail, Asher Tosim Lifnehem. And it's a striking idea, or an idea apparently of a strike. Why would Moshe want to take off work here and not want to go into detail in explaining these rules specifically? And the Rashiv of Karabi Avner of Goldwicht explained that this has to do with the nature of these Mishpatim, these principles, where one could get the impression that these are rules that are shared by every society, and one could figure them out on their own. They're basic principles of civil law, and therefore, perhaps, they don't really have any divine quality to them. And this isn't really the case. They actually are just as much reflective of divine wisdom as all the rest of the Torah. And Moshe was concerned that people shouldn't get the wrong impression, so he wanted to perhaps preserve the mystery a little bit and just teach them in a basic way without going into so much detail. And here HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, actually, it's quite the opposite, that this is where you have to all the more so go into detail, because since they are principles that are somewhat accessible rationally and seem to make sense to us intuitively, this is the opportunity all the more so to understand the divine wisdom and to internalize the messages within them, and therefore all the more so there's an obligation to study these in detail and to understand them and to take advantage of that opportunity. And in fact, Rabbeinu Yonah writes on his commentary on Pirkei Avos, the first Mishnah, which says, Hevi Mesunim Bedin, which we normally translate to mean that one should be careful and deliberate in matters of justice, he adds an added component to it, that one should think carefully about the rules of Din, because this is a special opportunity one has to access the divine wisdom, given that it's presented in this context, where we already have somewhat of a foundation in which to understand these principles, and therefore the opportunity to internalize the divine wisdom is even greater than it is with the rest of the Torah. In terms of the more conventional understanding of Hevi Mesunim Bedin, the Gemara in Sanhedrin and Zayin Amud Beis actually derives that from here, from the juxtaposition of the end of last week's parsha to the beginning of this week's parsha. Last week's parsha ended with V'lo sala b'malos al mizbechi, that we should not have a staircase up to Mizbech, and this week's parsha begins telling us about the Mishpatim, and apparently the nature of the connection is that the Torah Tumim explains that just as when it comes to ascending to the Mizbech, we shouldn't have stairs which allow us to quickly run up them, so too we shouldn't walk proudly and rely on our own judgment without thinking carefully about what the rules actually dictate to us and teach us. The word lifnehem in this pasuk tells us two halachos, at least one that we have a requirement of dayanim who are qualified with smicha from Moshe Rabbeinu in order to carry out the dinim. Today we don't actually have that because that's tradition was cut off, and that smicha was itself only given in Eretz Yisrael, but we have the ability still to adjudicate most matters through a principle called Shlichus Ayhu, which sounds like it means that the judges that we have today act as messengers of the ordained judges. However, the Nesivos and the Chasam Sofer explain that it's somewhat of a different concept, but nonetheless, it is an idea that allows us to appoint judges to carry out the rules of Din, even in the absence of smicha. And we limit these to matters that are common, and also to matters that are considered to be mamon rather than kenas, meaning they refer to direct compensation rather than punitive measures. In addition, the idea of Lifnehem also tells us that they should be presented only in front of Jewish courts and not in front of Arkoseihem, not in front of secular courts. And here, this concept applies even if the secular court would follow the same rules, the same halachos as we follow. And there are many different explanations of why that is. Some understand that we want specifically that the dinim should be a source of praising God's Torah, and as the Yisnaim Torah points, we don't want people to think that we don't have chachamim within the Jewish people. Overall, the notion of requiring that our litigation should be handled specifically in Beis Din is a way of displaying our belief in the halachic system and our willingness to live our lives regarding matters through the rules of halacha, including our monetary concerns. And one may think that, okay, I will follow all the other rules of the Torah, but when it comes to my money, I'm not willing to trust the halacha. I have to take that to a civil court. And that is what we call a chil Hashem, limiting our faith in halacha to only distinct areas within our lives and not willing to extend that faith even to matters that we take very seriously, such as our money. There are additional interpretations as well. The Gemara in Erev and Adaf Mendalad Mibes tells us Asher Tassim Lifnehem reflects an obligation on the Rebbe to explain everything clearly and Laharos Panim to his students to show a kind and patient face in making sure that they understand everything clearly. The Yiznaim Latara comments that this halacha is here, or this entire parsha is here, in between Parshas Yisro and Parshas Truma before the construction of the Mishkan is begun, to show that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, even in the matters of building the Beis HaMikdash and building the Mishkan and such holy activities, one shouldn't get the impression that anything goes for the sake of a mitzvah, but rather HaKadosh Baruch Hu is sonei gezel ba'ola. He is not interested in anything that is stolen and anything that is acquired without following the rules of interpersonal halacha. The parsha actually begins regarding treatment of avadim, and the Yiznaim Torah comments that this is perhaps a surprising place to start. You might think that coming after our own enslavement, that this is the last thing we need to hear about. And yet this is the nature of man, that he is idealistic at the time when he is suffering, but as soon as he is in a position of power, all of a sudden he can automatically turn around and forget what he went through and be very harsh towards those who are in a similar position. So therefore, it is especially now when this mitzvah has to be emphasized and reinforced. Pasuk Zayin talks about one who would sell his daughter into slavery. As the Gemara Maseches Kedushin on Daf Chaf explains, that this is not a normal thing to do and something that would only be done if there was extreme desperation and no way to support the daughter otherwise. The Yiznaim Latarah actually comments that the language here of Ish Es Bito, rather than talking about the status as a father, is because this is not a fatherly thing to do. And he raises the question of, if indeed he is so desperate, so why doesn't he actually sell himself into slavery? And then, as the previous Psukim tell us, the master will be able and obligated to support the children as well. And he suggests that perhaps his hope is that he should be able to redeem her as quickly as possible, and it's much more likely that that will happen if he is free on the outside to be able to take measures to do that, rather than if he is himself enslaved and he will have a much harder time creating a situation of redemption. Pasuk Yudalid tells us about the punishment of Misa for somebody who murders someone else, and the language is v'chi yazid, that he does so intentionally. And Chazal, the Gemara in Sanhedrin and Afim Aleph, tells us from here the obligation of Hasra, that when Beis Din execute someone, it only happens if the Aver was committed after first being warned by two witnesses and accepting the warning. And the Gemara has a discussion as to what the function of that warning is. According to one opinion, it is to distinguish those who are intentional, mezidim, from those who are shogim, who aren't aware. But the awareness seems to be of a higher level, because we find that this hasra, this warning, has to take place specifically within Toch Kedid Yibor, immediately before the sin takes place. And the Gemara indicates that if it's any longer than that, he may have forgotten the warning. And that's a surprising idea. The Ketzos HaChosha and others have a very hard time trying to figure out how we should assume that somebody's going to forget something that happened more than 10 seconds ago. And the Toch Kedid Yibor is at most 9 seconds, and is it really a concern that if just that short period elapses, the individual is actually going to forget that he's just been warned that he's committing a crime that could have him put to death? And Rav Soloveitchik suggested that the message here is that Hasra is not simply to make sure one is aware intellectually that there is an Aveira here with a punishment, but it's more than that. That the idea is, if somebody is going to be executed for committing a crime, it indicates that they are intensely aware of exactly what they are doing and that they are intentionally rebelling against God. And therefore, the standard for that, what the Rav expressed as establishing ad heichan hu parek ol, to what extent is this person rebelling against the entire system, is that he's not only aware intellectually, if you ask him, but he's actively thinking about the Avera and its consequences at the time that he does it. So in order to establish that that's the case, it has to be that the Avera takes place immediately after receiving the Hasra, when it's still in his active consciousness, and he proceeds to commit that Avera anyway. Pasuk Tesvav tells us about the punishment of Misa for striking one's parent. The language is Umakei Aviv V'imo, and the Gemara Maseches Chulin and Daf Yud Aleph Mid Beis tells us that this is one of the sources telling us that we rely on a majority, because the question of how can one be put to death for striking his father, the possibility is always there that he's not actually his father. But apparently, even for halachas of this magnitude, we rely on the presumption that in most cases, the mother's husband is indeed the father, and therefore that rov is sufficient for this purpose. And we can understand from here that across the board, we rely on rov for even matters of great severity of Torah law. The Aliyah ends off telling us, V'rapo yirape, that we shall heal. This is referring to the obligation to compensate one who has been injured at our hands and pay the medical bills. But the Gemara has a drasha on this language that mikan shiyesh rishus lerofe lerapos, that we see here that there is permission given to the doctor to heal. That's the Gemara in Bava Kamma daf peches amud aleph. And that seems to be a very surprising heter, because one would think that this is obvious, that this is permitted. In fact, we normally assume that it's a mitzvah to heal when possible. It's actually derived from the concept of hashavas aveda. If we're obligated to return property to one who is missing that property, all the more so we're obligated to restore their health. So we consider that to be a mitzvah. The notion that here that it's considered to be a heter, that it's a permission, requires some explanation. So there are at least two ways to understand this in the Rishonim. One is more legal and one is more philosophical. The philosophical one is that we might come to the conclusion that if God has chosen to make this person sick, so perhaps we don't have any permission to try to thwart his will and to heal this person. And we are taught that we're not ever actually empowered to thwart God's will. He will make any decisions he wants to, but he has given us the obligation to feed the hungry and to provide for the poor and to heal the sick. And therefore, indeed, if someone is in this disadvantaged position, we are given the opportunity to show chesed to them and to help them, including healing the sick. The more legal understanding of it is that one might think that, especially if we're talking about surgery or the like, that there shouldn't be any permission to cut into someone or to take any action that may indeed cause them further harm, or that at least begins with an act of chaval, an act of wounding them. And the Torah tells us here that as long as a person is qualified and knows what he's doing, therefore the mandate to heal overrides whatever steps that may seem prohibited that are necessary in order to provide this healing to the individual. The Liskarov, the Znayama Torah, adds another note here that the permission given to a doctor specifically is to heal and not to discourage. And therefore, it's not within the rights of the doctor in this understanding to say that you are dying and there is no hope, but his permission is only to bring both emotional help and physical assistance and to heal. And the rest is in the hands of God.